Warning, do not listen to this podcast if hearing about freedom and liberty is not legal for you in your community. And if so, you should immediately move to a hipper community.
Welcome to the Freedom Fiends Podcast, a weekly web lab where Michael W. Dean and Nima Vedati cover the punk rockinist, hip-hopinist current events, as well as timeless universal truths about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, because there's no such thing as half-free. The Freedom Fiends Podcast, available from freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfiends.com.
Freedom Fiends is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network at LRN.FM.
Welcome to the Freedom Fiends Distance Learning Anarchy Series with Freedom Fiends Michael W. Dean.
Broadcasting from my windowless bunker.
And Nima Vedati.
Go, go, Freedom Fiends!
Yo, Freedom Fiends.
Yo, welcome. That's me. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm one half of the Freedom Fiends, apparently.
Yeah, you did a great interview with Garrett Fox yesterday. I got to learn what you secretly think about me. It was
Mr.
pretty cool.
Mr. Fox. Oh, really?
I liked it. It was like, you know, your criticism of me was my strong points, and you knew that. You were like, yeah, Michael's really like obsessed about making sure the media is archived forever in case we get droned, and I'm just not that organized. And I'm like, yeah, you know, that's how we get stuff done. I mean, that's how the other day I decided, while you were out eating burgers in Dallas, I was like, we're going to have Fiends buttons. And I created yes. them, ordered them, paid for them, got Emberly to be the person, you know, sending them out for people, had them shipped to her, had some shipped to you and me. They're on our way. It's all yes. good, man. Fiends buttons. Yes,
there was no criticism in that. I was saying it was because of your passion. Also, yeah, I was very thankful for your obsession with it.
I know. You know, I do not have that first podcast we did that was before the Freedom Fiends.
You don't?
It was for like, that was for the Nestlandia podcast or Nestlandia yeah. website or something.
It's not archived on Kitty Feet somewhere.
No, it's not. No, I wiped out Kitty Feet before I changed it from my
to Anarchy Gumbo.
Art site to Anarchy Gumbo. Yeah, I've had that domain for 15 years. But yeah, I was like, it was like a purging. It was like, there's nothing on there I'll never need again. And I deleted it all. Now there's a few things I wish I'd kept.
Speaking of Anarchy Gumbo, my wife has become more enamored with anarchy once she realized it was associated with various foods like Anarchy Gumbo and the classic Anarchy Burger.
Hold the government. Yeah,
hold the government.
I'm going to put that Vandal song in the pod link. Anarchy Burger, yeah, hold the government, which is really, it's all about chaos. It's not about anarchy.
It is.
Like, you know.
But it's great.
Say fuck in front of your mom. Well, that's kind of anarchy. You do that. But, you know, go to school naked was a line in it. It was great.
Yeah, yeah. Wonderful song and great chorus, too. Like, it almost made me want to sample it and, you know, half speed it and turn it into a hip-hop song. Although I'd probably have to do more than half speed it because it sounds like it's at 200 BPM or something.
You know, I was looking at CNN or something. They have, you know, those like top 15 blah blah blah, and it's different stuff, and they had one that was like 15 detention slips from high school that you wouldn't want to get. And, you know, a lot of them were like, you know, he jumped up on the desk and grabbed his crotch and said, right here, bitch. But a couple of them were like kids correcting the teacher and getting in trouble for it. And I loved it because I used to do this all the time. There was one where it was like the teacher was saying that a kilometer is longer than a mile, and the class was all nodding and going, oh, wise teacher. And this one kid got detention for saying, no, a mile is longer than a kilometer, you're wrong. And the teacher was arguing with the kid, and like, you know, in the detention note it said, like, you know, I found out later he was right, but that's still no excuse for his behavior.
Really? That's no excuse.
Yeah. And then there was another one where they were like, had computer classes. And, you know, they were using Internet Explorer because that's what it's set up on the school computers to use. And the kid got detention for downloading some weird program called Firefox.exe and using it. And the teacher said, you're not doing your homework. Quit downloading and using other programs. And to which he said, no, it's a better browser. And he argued with me, and the teacher gave him detention.
Wow. Wow. Doesn't that about sum it up, though? I remember going through school and trying to correct teachers on a few points. Sometimes it worked, but sometimes it didn't. Like, sometimes I would just shut my mouth, which is that really how we want the learning environment to be? I mean, shouldn't it be about the search for truth or the search for the right answer rather than deference to authority?
Yes.
And, you know, I did have some teachers that did respect me, like my English teacher, Mr. Merle. Sometimes I would bring up a point and try to correct him, and he would say, oh, and we would look it up and go, okay, you're right. I had other teachers who I guess I'll leave nameless now, who just got offended and gave me the stink eye.
Name names.
I can't remember her name, though. But
come on,
man.
When you were sitting there fuming at that teacher, don't you wish you could say, in 20 years, I'll have a radio show where I can make fun of you in front of people?
No, not this particular one I'm thinking about, because she was other than that one instance where I called her out on something, she was generally a decent teacher. But I will say a name again that I dropped in Garrett Fox's podcast, Mrs. Rupp. I don't even remember her first name. Does anybody know their teacher's first name? It's kind of rare.
No.
She was Mrs. Rupp. She was my sixth grade teacher, and she physically harassed me by grabbing my arm and telling me I put her through hell, and F her, man.
Mrs. So, Rupp. So you haven't been keeping up on updating the CZ and streaming server, so I did it for you last night.
Oh, yeah, my bad. With the Sunday show?
Yeah, we're updated to current now. But
okay.
I'll let you do this one. Yeah.
Okay.
So I've been working on this new product service website, product/service/website that I can't say what it is yet, but I'm working on it with this white hat hacker dude, Hero, and it's going to, I mean, it's something that could go public. It's like real, you know, great business model. And it's going to be something that I'll just say it'll help artists and content creators share their stuff more effectively.
Yeah, man. It looks awesome. Yeah. Takes a lot of the annoying non-creative work that goes with spreading your art if you're an artist.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I feel that way a lot too, and I know a lot of artists feel that way. I mean, artists are artists because they want to create and be immersed in creative aspects and making something, producing something. But to be a successful artist, you have to be good at promoting and distributing and all this other kind of stuff, or have somebody that'll do it for you. And I think your new business model coming out will go a long way to helping that pressure, take that pressure off.
And of course, I've already got someone else to do it for me. Sean DeValley is doing the uploads to it for the beta. Yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of cool. It's like, this is the first time in my life I've ever, like, not only been in the ground floor at something that's going to be big, probably, but, like, you know, helped create it to the point where, like, you know, there's a beta test going on right now that's very useful to the fiends, and I'm the only one who has a password to it. Well, me and Sean.
Yeah.
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 You don't even have it.
No, I don't.
Because you wouldn't do it. Yeah.
I could.
Yeah, I know. I know. You're busy eating burgers and going on vacation, man. That picture of you, on Garrett's pod interview with you, you look like an Arab prince, man. Anytime you're on vacation, you pretty much look like an Arab prince.
Like an Arab prince? Oh, I'm an Arab now? That's racist. I'm Persian.
I know. Someone else said that to me when I posted that on Facebook, but yeah, you look.
No, I know what you mean. I look like I'm living in the lack of luxury, just because I'm so happy.
There's something about, like, your manner of dress and even your sunglasses and just your, like, leaning back. You look like beyond rich. Like, yeah, like you're the black sheep of the Arab oil family. You know, like, oh yes, our son Nima, he goes off and goes with the whores in Monaco, and we have to bail him out so often.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when I was buying those sunglasses, I was like, okay. These make me look like I got that Arab money.
We had to buy him diplomatic immunity to get him out of trouble. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I see what you're saying. I don't take offense.
So the topic today is going to be drug treatment history. Drug treatment and the state. But we're not going to get there yet. First, we're going to talk about libertarian or rapper. Take the quiz. Did you take that yet?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I almost had some deja vu. Did we talk about that on the cast, or did I just look that up?
I just liked it because, no, I came up with the idea a long time ago. I was like, you know, libertarian rappers are almost libertarian if they just have the non-aggression principle. I mean, you know, they're into weed, they're into guns, they're into gold. They don't like the cops. They're practically libertarians. And
yeah. Well, somebody, I talked about that on my interview with Free Talk Live when I first made Eye on Me as well.
That was before I never heard that. I heard you talk about that. I have to go back and find that now. But because I am a Nima Vedati completist.
But, what does that mean?
It means I want to hear everything you've ever done.
Oh.
I'm a fan. You know, I'm not just your co-host. I'm a fan. Excellent. So, yeah, but Mother Jones magazine, which is a lefty magazine, which, you know, I mean, I agree with half what they say and half of it's horrible. They were kind of making fun of Ron Paul.
Yeah.
And they had a quiz called Libertarian or Rapper. And it had a bunch of quotes, you know, and you'd pick Libertarian and Rapper. And I got like 3 out of 10, man. I thought it was all rapper stuff. You know, I mean, you know, like one was like, favorite piece of jewelry was a gold chain, a dollar sign in gold, you know, on a chain. And I was like, rapper. And it's like, nope, Ayn Rand wore that, you know.
Well, do you want to go through and you can give me the quiz and see how well I
did? Yeah, let's do that right now. I'll open it up.
Okay.
And, you know, I was watching the Ron Paul speech at Tampa today. It was friggin' great. He just basically bashed the hell out of the GOP and called them tyrants. It was wonderful.
Yeah. I didn't see that, but I did see his interview with Neil Cavuto at the convention, and Cavuto kept like pressing him. He's like, so you're here, but you're not going to endorse Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan. You're not going to endorse the ticket. And Ron Paul was like, no, they don't talk about what I want to talk about. Okay. And he's very polite, but very, very much firm in his position, which is one of the things I love about Ron
like,
Paul.
You're like, Was it the fat guy? You know, who you did an interview with the fat guy on Fox? I'm like, which one, man? That's like saying the blonde bimbo on Fox.
Yeah, yeah. Although Neil Cavuto is kind of cool. I don't want to just reduce him to that. I don't want to be fattest.
You know.
I got quite a belly myself now.
I know. Well, I've lost like 4 pounds on the modified paleo diet in a week.
Have you? So, nice. Yeah. When you say how did you modify it?
Well, like, we're true paleo diet, you never have any milk, but I'm having like milk in my coffee, which means I'm having like 2 tablespoons of milk a day, but I usually drank a gallon of milk a day. So it's, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. Okay. Libertarian or rapper, take the quiz. Oh, also on the Daily Paul site, there was a thread about what can we do in Tampa to stir up shit and not stir up shit, but like, you know, promote Ron Paul. And people formulated a plan. It was to start a pirate radio station blasting Ron Paul speeches and then drive it around in a car and then get have a projector, you know, digital projector projecting, you know, like 91.3 FM all over town driving around. And the link they had for the how to do the radio station was to the Freedom Fiends Make Your Own Liberty Station for $250 article by our friend Cash Newman.
Nice.
Yep.
That's awesome. And speaking of Mother Jones and Ron Paul, before we get into the Libertarian Rapper quiz, did you see their write-up on Ron Paul supporters rebelling on the convention floor?
Yeah.
Man, that picture of that guy flipping both
flipping
birds.
Flipping the
saying,
bird. I know.
Fuck you, tyrants.
F you. Yeah. Yeah. And I tweeted that and said, like, oh, those damn uppity Ron Paul supporters destroying the unity of the GOP. I don't think it was quite that long. That and a URL wouldn't fit on Twitter. Writing Twitter is like writing a telegram, man. It's like, you're almost paying by the word. You're so limited by it.
Yeah. What is it, 150 characters?
I don't know, 62 or something. It's a annoying short sentence and a shortened link, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, then I posted that somewhere else and said, Republicans about to become ANCAPs. I can't wait,
Welcome.
Man. I can't wait to have their support and donations November 7th.
Yeah,
we got to do an ad. We got to do an ad and, like, maybe...
Welcoming Ron Paul, folks.
You know, get it somewhere that isn't just our closed little big world.
Okay.
Yeah.
Although, speaking of Ron Paul and Rand Paul, you said in his speech his son Rand introduced him and you just skipped through it.
Yeah, I listened. I thought it was going to be like a minute long. It was like 15 minutes long. And I'm like, I don't want to hear this Ron Paul light tyrant, man. Get to the, you know, don't bore us. Get to the chorus. Song.
I don't even think he's Ron Paul light.
I know. He's Ron Paul fake.
Yeah.
What is that? Ben did a whole...
He's Crystal Pepsi. He's something completely different, but wrapped up in similar packaging.
No, he's like generic Mexican cola that has rat poison in it or something. Because that's how the free market works, man. You get rat poison in your cola, according to statists.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's take the libertarian, or let's quiz libertarian rapper Nima Vedati. All right. Now, don't try to guess like, oh, this is a trick question. Just say like which you think it is. Okay, was this a rapper or a libertarian? Licked whipped cream off the chests of two bucks and women at Leukemia Society luncheon.
If it was a libertarian, I would guess Robert P. Murphy, but I think this is probably a rapper, so I'm going to go with rapper.
Incorrect.
Really?
2008 Libertarian Party presidential candidate Rob Barr.
Bob Barr? Oh,
Bob Barr, yeah.
He's sorry. So square.
I know.
I didn't even consider him a libertarian, though.
Well, I always thought he looked like a porn star. He was a retired porn star. Okay.
Yeah, it does.
Next. Quote, I learn to earn because I'm righteous.
It's got to be a rapper.
Yeah. Eric B. and Rakim paid in full.
Ah, okay. Okay, great.
Quote.
Hold on. It doesn't say if it was Eric B. or Rakim, and I don't remember which one it was. Who said okay. that exactly?
I can't go okay. back.
Oh, okay. Doing? All right. Fair enough.
Quote. Who said, so you think that money is the root of all evil? Have you ever asked what is the root of money?
It doesn't really rhyme or have too much of a rhythm to it, so I'm going to say that was a libertarian.
Okay. Correct. Ayn Rand, yeah. Atlas Shrugged. Oh, and the like the buttons you pick on, the libertarian one is a picture of Ron Paul, and the rapper one is like, I don't know who it is. I think it's a generic rapper or someone from the 80s. It might be like Eric B. and Rakim or like even like...
No, I think it's the Don't Copy That Floppy rapper.
Is it?
No, but it would be funny
if it was. Someone from that era. They're wearing like, you know, a fedora and a leather jacket and an Izod shirt and like tipping their hat.
It's such a small picture. Let me try to zoom in and see if I can.
All right.
I have no idea, man.
Indicted in 2009 for failure to pay taxes for 3 years, accused of treating his nonprofit like a personal ATM.
If the state, the state goes after rappers and libertarians. So that's tough to tell too, who got knocked on that. This is just a guess, but I'm going to go with rapper.
Incorrect. Bill Sizemore, Oregon anti-tax activist and former libertarian gubernatorial candidate.
Huh. Don't know who that is. So what am I, two and two now?
Don't know until we're done. Okay. At press time, the IRS was dodging him for owing $6.6 million in back taxes.
The IRS was dogging him for owing $6.6 million in back taxes. The press time of this story. Yeah. Well, let me see when the story was posted.
You're overthinking these, man. It's like a Rorschach test. Come on.
Okay,
bang,
fine.
Bang, 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 bang.
Rapper.
Correct. Suge Knight.
Okay.
Favorite article of bling, gold dollar sign pin.
I think that's a misdirect. I'm going to go with libertarian.
Yeah, I already told you that. It was Ayn Rand.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But you forgot because you're baked.
I'm not baked.
Okay, quote, cash rules everything around me.
Oh, duh. Wu-Tang Clan, rapper.
Yep. From the song C-R-E-A-M.
Cream. That stands for cash rules everything around me.
Yep. America needs fewer laws, not more prisons.
Libertarian.
Correct. James Bovard from Lost Rights.
There you go.
Shocked fans with his 2008 release, Legalize All Drugs.
Ooh. See, that could go either way, too. 2008 release. We'll say libertarian.
Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom should be in this. I mean, that,
it should. So, it
but
should.
That'd be both. It'd be libertarian rapper.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, you're correct. John Stossel.
Nice.
All right. Quote, I'm all for America. Fuck the government.
Well, I'd say a lot of libertarians in the public eye are kind of not square statist, but, you know, polite. So I'm going to say rapper on this one.
Eminem in Rap Game.
Ah, that's actually a great song. It's with him and 50 Cent.
You got 8 out of 10. I got 3 out of 10, man. I thought they were all rappers. They all sounded like rappers to me. Yeah.
Huh. Well, I guess I know about more about rappers than you. So that's a big surprise.
Well, I should hope so. Yeah. I just play one on TV. You are one.
There you go.
So did you see Breaking Bad the other day?
No, I'm going to wait until the season's over so I can watch it in its entirety. Okay, plus, well, I don't have... Is there a way to watch that on demand?
Yeah, it's called BitTorrent.
Yeah, but that's still the same. I have to download the whole thing, and then I have to wait, you know... I guess I could do that.
Dude, anyway.
I don't know. With Breaking Bad, I like to sit there and watch it over the course of like a day or two.
I mean, I don't recommend anyone using BitTorrent illegally, so
yeah,
scratch that. I have a prediction, and to people who haven't seen this season or the last episode, this is a, what do you call it?
Spoiler?
Yeah.
Should I plug my ears?
I was going to say deal breaker. Yeah, okay, plug your ears.
No, I'll listen. Okay. Screw it.
I predict that Mike is not really dead. He's going to limp to Mexico across the river and get stitched up by Gus's doctor and come back gunning for Walt, probably with Jesse's help. That's why in the previous scene of the first episode of this season, Walt was buying a machine gun.
So Mike is the new villain? You don't want to get too far into it. I was wondering what they were going to do, because the thing with Breaking Bad is I always wonder how the hell they're going to top the last episode.
Well, and the last honestly, season. I hate Walt now, and I like Mike and I like Jesse.
Oh, really?
I mean, we sound like a couple old ladies talking about their soap operas, but you know, yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. I mean, I always had problems with Walt, though. There are always things I found really questionable morally about his actions. Most specifically, when Jesse's heroin addict girlfriend and they were sleeping together, Walt
he let her
by.
Die. He let her die.
Yeah, they're both passed out, and she starts to yak.
We talked about that, though, about that was sort of self-defense, because she was going to put him in a cage for the rest of his life.
Yeah. I suppose.
He didn't kill her. He just didn't help her.
Yeah.
In some states, that's not even a crime in our current system. You know, in some states it is. But, yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. It just put a bad taste in my mouth for Walt, I guess. No homo.
So you turned me on to a video about the Kansas City Police Department making a propaganda video to get people used to SWAT raids. Like, SWAT raids are your friend. Here's what to do when they happen in your neighborhood and how to behave.
Yes. It's disgusting. I actually saw it from a Will Grigg post. He posted that, and I watched it. And the thing that struck me first of all was, okay, so Kansas City Police Department's public information office actually is making TV news packages to make themselves look good. And that was the format of them. They look exactly like how, you know, a local TV station would cover a
they probably air them
news
on TV. You know?
They might. I bet they, like, hand them off to the different TV stations, and if they're short on content, they'll play them. Because I know back in Wyoming, we used to have the Department of Fish and Hogs would always give us a weekly thing that we'd play on the weekends, and... Who else? Oh, the Department of Transportation. So it looks like the police department in Kansas City is now doing this. Because there was more than just one. It was more than the SWAT teams are your friends kind of thing. there was also one about officers getting more into patrol, and they're your friends. And they basically interviewed like 12 different cops in that one. And each one had the same catchphrase. Like, they all had a meeting about what to say on this thing. And their catchphrase was, "I'm an officer first." And it was just completely canned and lame. And I guess the thing, and this was Will Grigg's point too about the SWAT team one, is, I mean, why it's very disconcerting that they're going to such lengths to normalize this kind of military behavior, to normalize the fact that there'll be tanks patrolling your neighborhoods, and you better get used to it, and it's a good thing kind of thing.
Well, you have great insight to that a lot of people don't, because you worked in the mainstream media. And Pete Eyre from Cop Block had me write an article about guns and weed for Cop Block, which came out today. I'll link it. It's called "Why I Had to Make the Movie Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom." And I suggested that he have you write an article about, you know, how an insider's view of how the news works with the cops to be their mouthpiece. And he liked it, and you're going to work on it. So
yeah, I am. And you know, this SWAT team thing, it was almost like cutting out the middleman, because the media does this kind of thing, and even media does it, the police department usually has a big say over how it's portrayed. For instance, I did a package when I was in Washington State where they were doing SWAT training. It was like county to county. So the county I lived in and the next door county were working together to get their SWAT team to do a practice. It's one of those mock terrorism situations where they close down a school, you know, on a weekend, and they do like a fake terrorism thing, and they have students be actors and all this kind of gay stuff. And the guy who was in charge of it, the SWAT captain, he was so reticent. Like, all the other reporters left early to get their deadline, but I was working on the night shift, so my story wasn't due till 10. And he was pretty miffed, it seemed, that I had stayed later to actually get the results of the exercise. Because it's civilians, I think, were actually shot by the cops in the exercise. There were some mishaps, and there were some officers that were shot as well by the perpetrator. And the captain sort of didn't really want this kind of stuff to be out there. He just wanted there to be nice video of these strong men and with big guns trying to protect you. He didn't really want it to be an issue of tactics. Oh, and that's the other thing they always do. They never want to explain their tactics or their methods or their strategies. But I feel like, shouldn't that be kind of open source stuff if there are supposed employees?
Because their tactics are breaking in the door of people who it's not proved they've done a crime, and throwing a flashbang grenade in to disorient them and wake them up, and shooting any pets or people who get in the way or bark.
Right. I mean, I understand completely why they don't want their tactics to be espoused, but I do wonder why the public doesn't demand this kind of transparency from them more.
Because of things like this video.
Yeah, yeah.
And the news, you know, giving the free pass and the, hey, you're all great kind of thing. All right, let's take a little, go sell some things here and then come back and drop some mad science about drug rehab in the state.
All right, sounds good to me.
Hi, I'm Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends, and like you, I'm concerned with privacy on the internet. The electronic police state is strangling our previous protections, and the central scrutinizer is trying to squint into all areas of our lives. That's why smart people surf the net with a VPN or virtual private network. I use a VPN from Bola VPN. Bola VPN has your utmost security in mind and will allow you to surf, email, and do other computing tasks without leaving a trail of breadcrumbs across the internet. Unlike many other VPN providers, Bola VPN doesn't log traffic. With Bola VPN, you can change your apparent location or disappear completely. Bola VPN has been around since 2007, which is OG in the VPN world. Bola VPN is easy to install and configure. Best of all, it can be had for less than 25 cents a day, which is a small price to pay for this much security. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them through the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net. You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. We have Freedom Fiends, Anarchy Gumbo, and 2 designs for Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists. It's only $6 for 4 buttons, including shipping. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
What's up, Fiend?
Chillin', Fiend.
So, I found this giant JPEG, which I'm going to list. It's from a site called drug-rehab.org.
Speaking of fiends, I'm
still trying to figure out what fiends. I'm trying to figure out what they're a front for. You know, I mean, I can't even tell if this is just like a website with ads that, you know, shows up in high in SEO and you know, they get paid by click, or if it's an actual organization, particular organization, or if it's a front group for Scientology. I don't know. You know, Scientology has a drug rehab.
Yeah. According to their website, they're a nonprofit drug and alcohol rehab referral and placement service.
Yeah. So
they've got an 800 number.
It's probably not Scientology, but Scientology has a drug rehab called Narcanon. And I used to get confused. I used to confuse Narcanon with Naranon. Naranon is like the Narcotics Anonymous equivalent of Al-Anon. You know, it's like for the families of drug addicts to get.
Yeah, I didn't know they were two separate things.
Right. And, you know, I never remember, like, which is the good one and which is the scary one. And I just remember, well, Narcanon's the bad one. It has the word narc.
It has narc in it.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a friend that somebody, you know, he was a drug addict in L.A., and he was really toe up. You know, he's, like, used to be a well-known musician, and then, you know, like gold record having musician, and then, you know, ended up homeless. And one of his friends was like, you know, I can help you. And he took him to this place and they basically kidnapped him. Like after 12 hours, they would not let him leave. And it wasn't, they had no legal right to do that. You know, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like being committed kind of thing or even self-committed. It was just like, they brought him there and he was like, after 12 hours, he was like, he wanted to leave because they were spooky, he thought. And, you know, they were like, no, you came in, you can't leave. And he finally like started screaming the names of, you know, people they've heard of that he said he was going to get them to get lawyers, and they let him out.
So how did he eventually, they let him leave and he went back to being an addict, or did he cure himself?
He went back to being an addict and then later went to a non-scary inpatient program that he was brought in by something called MAP, which is Musicians Assistance Program. I have no idea whether they're like government funded or not, but from what I know about them, they're a good organization. I know a lot of people in LA. Basically, if you're a musician, you know, who's put out a record, like you don't even have to be famous. If you're a musician, like they'll help pay for your treatment, you know?
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yep. And, yeah, he actually went through a kind of nice place because he had musicians union insurance.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard of that. They've got posters for that around the Austin area guitar centers, like up on the bulletin board.
Yeah, like you'll get insurance. But, you know, it was also like, you know, I think his record company paid or something. I mean, the guy was, I'm not going to say who he was, but he was, you know, somebody that's been on the cover of Spin and Rolling Stone and has gold records and, you know, played Woodstock 2 and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the thing about drug treatment and drug addiction in America is it's kind of murky. There is something to be said for people who are true addicts and need help and want help and seek it voluntarily from organizations that do it. But it's been so tainted by the state, it's sometimes hard to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah. And even the organizations that run on a shoestring budget and do good work that get some funding from the state and a lot from private donors. Like, for instance, I'm thinking of the Haight-Ashbury Detox Clinic in San Francisco, which I got clean through their outpatient program and then basically stayed clean by going to meetings and changing my whole life. I was talking with a girl that I know that used to be my roommate. She and her boyfriend were junkies and both, now they're both clean. We got clean around the same time, 93, 94. And, you know, I was talking to her about libertarianism and she liked the idea of it, but she's like, you know, her think of the roads. She didn't even bring up the roads. She was like, well, how would addicts get sober if there weren't government funded places like the place you got sober, Michael? Like, she was basically calling me a hypocrite for bad mouthing government after getting clean through a place that gets, you know, 10% of its funding from the government and the rest from wealthy patrons who, you know, went through there.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, the structure of that kind of place is such that it's become dependent on the 10% from the government. Yep. If they'd never had it, they'd still be around, man. They do a good service and people would provide something for them.
Yeah, exactly. But a lot of them fall into that trap. The government court orders people to go to drug rehab at a for-profit and then pays for the for-profit or forces the person who was court ordered to pay for it themselves, which basically gives them guaranteed customers, and they sort of have to build their business model around it. And they become dependent on that kind of money, which isn't true market money.
What we're going to talk about today a lot of is going back into the history of how long that's been happening and how it happened. But I mean, I have a friend who's not a libertarian who got busted about 10 years ago for, you know, pulled over for drunk driving, and he had, you know, blew a whatever, like barely drunk, but he had some coke on him, like a gram or something. And the judge, you know, he spent a couple nights in jail, and then the judge ordered him to go to AA meetings, which this guy to this day hates AA and says it's horrible and it's evil. And I tried to explain to him, like, no, you know, AA isn't anything to do with the state. The judge ordered him, you know, and I guess AA meetings could say, well, some do. I mean, basically, when you get court ordered, they give you a card to sign, and the secretary of the meeting signs it for you. And some secretaries, including me, when I ran an NA meeting, will not sign that card. You know, they're like, go to another meeting where they'll sign it, or sign it yourself, or, you know, whatever. Because I think an important part of 12-step programs is that it is voluntary. Even yeah. Dale Evert, who I interviewed recently, who's, you know, stone cold atheist. I mean, stone cold agnostic. Sorry. No, he's actually a Quaker. He's a stone cold anarchist. Thank you. you know, has a problem with AA because he thinks it's connected to the state. And I explained to him, no, it's not, you know. Yeah.
You know, that was actually one of the examples I put in my letter of resignation for the news station was this woman I'd interviewed. I did a story, you know, they love to do budget cut stories and show, look at these poor people who aren't getting this money because the state had to cut the budget, you know, kind of a thing to make you want the state to not cut the budget. And I interviewed this woman at one of these. It was an actual business. It was a voluntary business, a private business that did rehab, but a lot of their customers were court ordered or were forced to go there by the state, or the state paid for it. Various different government and state pseudo ties. And this one woman I interviewed, she was just a mess. And they made it seem like the meth was the real villain in her life. But to me, in her story, it seemed like the state was the real villain. She couldn't afford to pay for rehab herself because her husband was in jail. The only reason her husband was in jail was for a nonviolent meth offense. So if the state didn't lock up her husband, throw her husband in jail, she would have the money to volunteer, and he would have the money too, to voluntarily admit themselves to a rehab, get clean. They'd still have their daughter or their son or whatever. They had a kid that basically had to be taken in by child protective custody. They would have had a whole family. They could have gotten better, at least ideally. They could have gone to rehab and gotten better. And their kid wouldn't have to go live in a foster home or in a center and be essentially an orphan. And the villain in all this was so obviously the state, not the meth. I mean, the meth is a problem, but yeah. the meth isn't a cage that her husband is staying in. The meth didn't take her kids away.
I've known a lot of drug addicts in my day, back from using and from in meetings, you know, recovering addicts and people trying to get clean who didn't. I've known a bunch of opiate users who had totally functional lives and could have forever. The guy who co-founded the Haight-Ashbury Detox Clinic, his daughter was my girlfriend, which was really kind of weird. But, you know, he also used to be Charles Manson's parole officer before he started that clinic. And there's another connection. It's like he was a parole officer and then he went to start a clinic. But he was a good guy. But he told me, you know, stimulants will destroy your body and nobody can use them recreationally for long term. But if you could get clean heroin, you know, that's medically pure, you could use it and be and you didn't have to like pay for it, you know, steal to pay for it if it didn't have an artificially inflated price. Mm-hmm. You could do heroin every day of your life and be, you know, an old, fairly happy, healthy person.
Yeah.
When you die of old age at 85 or 90. You know, he said the thing that kills addicts is, you know, the crimes they do, you know, getting shot in a robbery or getting killed in jail or whatever, you know, the starvation, you know, the bad lifestyle you have to live because it's illegal, and what, you know, often like diseases they get from sharing needles.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Hepatitis or HIV.
I would tend to think those are the majority of the problems. I still think even if there were no state to, you know, do these horrible things to people who like to take certain substances, I still think there would be people who maybe would abuse it to its end. Just like now there are people that die of alcohol poisoning. I think there could be a small percentage of people that would die from heroin overdose or morphine overdose. But why ruin society to prevent a few deaths like that, ostensibly, when these drug laws don't even prevent those deaths? They make everything worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
And, you know, I mean, I have actually met people who recreationally used speed for decades. You know, they generally had fewer teeth than the people that recreationally used heroin for decades. But
college students use Adderall all the time, which is an amphetamine. I mean, that's its medical name, amphetamine.
You know, we basically addressed this really well, I think, in the Guns and Weed movie with the line we wrote for Jay Tizzle where, you know, should race cars be outlawed? How about boxing? Camping in bear country? Those are all like drug use, doing something dangerous and exhilarating for kicks. You know, yep. Camping in bear country is encouraged by the state. I mean, Wyoming, you know, the whatever Department of commerce or the, you know, whatever,
fish
tourism,
and hogs.
Fish and hogs. I mean, you know, they take ads out in California saying, yeah, you know, visit beautiful Jellystone Park, Yellowstone National Park.
And billboards in Salt Lake City and I'm sure Denver.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They steal your money to promote that dangerous activity.
Yeah,
which I engage in because it's a blast. I love camping.
The last couple of years, a couple people been mauled and or killed by bears in Yellowstone, not camping, just walking around, man. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, they're off the beaten track and hiking and, you know, trying to feed them Doritos or pet their young or something. But, you know, feed Doritos to the bears. Winnebago warrior. Dead Kennedys.
That's a great song.
I love that.
Sounded like the Dead Kennedys.
Feed Doritos to the bears. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So do we want to get into the history?
Yeah.
Okay.
You've got some notes on it. Do you want to?
Yeah, I'll sort of go through some of these, and you can catch whatever you think I miss. You know, follow along in your actual timeline, and tell me if there's anything you think needs to be commented on.
Okay, I'm going to jump in with the to show where this starts. It starts in the 1700s to early 1800s. The first alcoholic mutual aid societies or sobriety circles are formed within various Native American tribes. Later, some will evolve into abstinence-based temperance organizations. Now, look at that. That's the state caused a problem. The state came in and brought in alcohol to Indians who couldn't handle it metabolically. You know, that's. I mean, there's like the cliche of the drunken Indian, but it's like literally that's a race of people that, unlike most of the rest of the world, didn't touch alcohol until the 1700s, you know.
Yeah.
And settlers brought it and traded it for their land and their pelts. But,
yeah, but even then, their solution, the Native American solution, was sobriety circles, which seems pretty stateless. Like, it seems like, you know,
but
if you were...
later, some evolved into abstinence-based temperance organizations. Temperance organizations are people who morally and legally want to outlaw everyone drinking.
Yeah, yeah. And that sort of seems to be the thread that goes through the timeline of the history of drug rehab is it's a story of the state taking control of an issue that the market was already working on.
Right. I mean, mutual aid societies, that's a perfect description for AA, which came much, you know, 200 years later. It's a great idea. It's friends helping friends. It's totally market-based. It's non-state-based. It's, you know, it's... four people meeting in their living room, which is illegal now. Did you hear about, it wasn't an alcohol thing, but some guy in, I think it was Kansas City or something, got arrested and put in jail for having a Bible meeting in his house because it broke the law of having too many people in his living room.
Yep. It was like a public meeting thing. Like you have to apply for a permit from the city to have that large of a meeting.
Well, you know, the first, I started an NA meeting, and you know, you're supposed to be anonymous with NA. That's the A is alcohol, is anonymous, you know, Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous. But I no longer consider myself a member, so I can break my anonymity without harming the organization or myself, which, you know, they have some really excellent bylaws or suggestions for not only getting sober, but for running the groups. You know, the originator of it, Bill Wilson, called AA a mixture, you know, a perfect or a useful mixture of anarchy and democracy, which we've talked about is like, well, that doesn't make sense, but it does if it's panarchy. You know, you can choose to have your democracy, and it is.
Exactly.
So the first, I started this NA meeting called Lust for Life in San Francisco, because when I first got sober in 94, there were, you know, all the meetings were like old people and bikers and, you know, not young hip people. And I felt out of place and they were staring at me because, you know, me and my friends had purple hair or something. So I started Lust for Life and it became very successful and did really well for 10 years. Like, you know, 4 years after I moved out of San Francisco, it was still going strong. And it met in a room at a rehearsal studio. And the lady who ran the place, you know, her son was an addict, which is not... You know, I'm not saying what studio it was or who she was, but, you know, it's common knowledge. And this guy has, like, I've seen him stand on stage and go, like, I love to shoot dope and bang groupies. So, you know, I'm not breaking his anonymity. And she allowed us to have it there free, probably hoping her son would come in, you know. Mm-hmm. And he did for a while eventually. Maybe, I think he's sober now. So, you know, we had this great meeting room at a rehearsal space. Like, you'd hear shitty bands rehearsing downstairs really loud in this place, which was really cool.
Yeah.
And I actually thought of the name of it while I was having sex with a black woman. I was, you know, we were at first we were going to call the meeting like Hip, Slick, and Cool Recovery or something, which is horrible because the AA has a saying of like, you know, if you're too hip, slick, and cool, you can't make it in recovery. Like basically saying like, if your ego gets in the way, you're not going to make it, which is true, but you can be hip, slick, and cool. So I was calling it like something like Hip, Slick, and Cool Recovery for the first two meetings. And then I was like, that's a horrible name. And I was having sex with this hot black chick. And I was like,
what's her name? Life?
No, I'm not going to say her name.
Okay.
But I like that. And I thought of it while I was doing it. So the first two meetings of that were public meetings at our house before we got the rehearsal space. We actually like put up signs at other, handed out signs at other, handbills at other meetings and invited people with my address on it to have it in my backyard, which is kind of a scary thing to do with recovery because it's like inviting,
I would think,
addicts who might still be using to your house.
Steal your TV to get a fix.
But we actually did it in the backyard without them coming into the house. We had them go through the alley and just stood out front for the first 10 minutes. And, you know, the first meeting had like three people at it. The next meeting had five. And then we brought it to the rehearsal studio and it had like, you know, between 20 and 50 every meeting for 10 years. So, Yeah.
Did the state ever come in and break up the party, or do you know what the current status is?
No, but there's actually something in the beginning of each NA meeting that's something about like, it's called We Do Recover, and it's something they read at the beginning of every meeting, and it's actually, and in it, it says one thing is the lie is dead, we do recover. And that's based on the fact that when NA started, it first started in the like 50s, because AA started in the 30s, and addicts would go to AA meetings because there wasn't something for addicts. And AA people would sometimes throw them out because they didn't want them there. So in the 50s, with the blessings of AA, NA took the 12 steps and started NA. And it didn't really catch on until the 70s. And in the 70s, it started getting popular in New York City and LA. And police used to drive, you know, they drive the rookies around in their car and they drive by the NA meeting and say, like, see those people standing there smoking cigarettes in front of that church basement? Memorize their faces. Bust them whenever you can.
Oh, my God. That's awful.
And so originally NA meetings were secret meetings and they were by candlelight. And then there was this guy named Frank Buchanan, who I've met. He passed away a few years ago. He was like 80. Really cute old gray-haired man that used to wear a suit and like a flower on his lapel all the time, and all the young girls loved him because he was cool and he was a rock star in AA and NA. And I can say his name because he was really open about his name and there've been articles about him. Frank Buchanan went to the head of the FBI, which was what's his name, horrible guy,
the guy who wore women's underwear.
Yeah, what's his name?
J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah. He went to D.C. and got a meeting with J. Edgar Hoover and told him, I work with this organization called Narcotics Anonymous. Addicts are staying clean. The lie is dead. Please tell cops nationwide to stop targeting us for trying to get clean. And Hoover actually did it because, like, Frank brought reporters and stuff, and there was a spotlight on it. And so they quit having to have candlelight meetings. There's actually still some candlelight meditation meetings, which are a throwback, like an homage to the fact that they used to have to hide.
Yeah.
But, yeah, but they're not secret anymore, and people do recover. Like in the 70s, you know, cops said, you know, addicts don't recover. They, you know, once an addict, always an addict. That was the lie. When they say the lie is dead, the lie was once an addict, always an addict. So, all right. So what's next on our list here?
Yeah, we kind of jumped ahead to the 70s and stuff, but in the 1780s.
Actually, it's time for us to sell some things.
Okay.
Want to contribute to Liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes. Follow twitter.com/fiendtorrents to grab the past episodes and new ones as they post. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents, while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding the fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down. That's twitter.com/fiendtorrents.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends podcast. Freedom Fiends is now available for 24/7 streaming to your iPhone, Android phone, or other chromed robot turd. Click on the streaming audio link on freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfeens.com.
Morphines, please. Morphine, please.
Morphine for the morphine fiends.
You know, there was this band in Philadelphia, punk rock band, back when my band Bomb was together, called More Fiends, which had this really hot chick in it that I used to have a crush on. I knew her.
Ah.
Morphines, though. That's a good... It should be fiends. But this was like 86, 87. I don't know if people said fiends yet. As back commented then. In. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My father-in-law had surgery recently, and he was enamored by the morphine button. He was like pressing it, and he kept calling it morphine.
It's like the button to God, you know? Yeah, it's like paging heaven, paging heaven.
Well, he used to be a pharmacist, and he remembers some trade publication where they were making fun of this guy. They called him a criminal. He like got his hands on some prescription, you know, the things where you write the prescription in, and he pads, wrote like 300 prescription pads. He wrote like 3,000 hits of morphine, and spelled it like M-O-F-E-E-N. And he got arrested, and it was sad.
Yeah. See, kids, stay in school or you'll get arrested. Learn the basics of spelling and math. It'll help you. When you're sitting there in class going, how will this help me in later life being able to spell? That's how it'll help you.
Steal morphine more effectively.
Yeah. Kids. All right. I was going to tell a story about when I did my paid coke research at UC Parnassus in California, but it'll make people fiend, so I'm not going to tell it.
It'll make people fiend?
Yeah.
In what way?
Well,
for the fiends.
What they did was they was being paid by the government to take intravenous cocaine, and they hooked me up to this. You know, I'm lying in a reclining chair, and they put a butterfly serrate in my arm, or you know, like one of those little things they use to put a tube in your arm, you know,
they
have to do a drip, and then taped it down in my vein in the crotch of my elbow in the front, and then they hooked it up to this machine that had a syringe of clear liquid in it that had like a quarter gram of pure pharmaceutical cocaine or something, just an amazing amount, like an almost OD amount that was wonderful. And they turned on the machine, and instead of just shooting it in your vein, like if you were shooting it, which takes about, you know, half second, it took a minute to push the plunger in, and the liquid was cold. Anybody out there who's done coke is like getting their buttholes twitching right now. It was cold liquid. I could feel it going in my vein, and it came on kind of slowly and like more and more and more intense in waves. And then I was like, you know, when I'm a billionaire, I just want to like have that at home with a nurse, a naughty nursey.
Yeah, I can't do it, man. I hate anything delivered intravenously. I can't even give blood. I pass out.
So let's move on here.
Creeps me out.
I've never given blood, but when I get blood tests, you know, my veins are kind of fucked up. Because, you know, I used to shoot drugs. Like, there's scar tissue in my veins, which is another thing that's the state's fault. Because, you know, if junkies could get clean needles every time like diabetics do, that wouldn't be the problem.
Yep.
Diabetics don't shoot in the vein, but, you know, junkies use insulin syringes. That's the standard. They have really small needles. And but, you know, they end up having to use them over and over because they're hard to get. So they get dull. Mm-hmm. But I've been given a blood sample before, and, like, almost said to the nurse, like, here, let me do it, when she couldn't find a vein. And, you know, but then I'll generally say, like, well, that one's kind of tapped out. You might try this one right here in my wrist, you know.
You're not worried that they're going to call the cops and call you?
No, because I tell them I'm a recovering addict. It's that is a matter of public record, man.
Yeah, it sure is.
And it's not illegal yet to be, you know, someone who hasn't done drugs in 2 years or whatever.
Right. The lie is currently over.
Although there's some guy that, I forget if it was Canadian and they wouldn't let him into the U.S. or vice versa. I think it was Canadian writer, philosopher, teacher, university professor that they wouldn't let in the United States because they read something where he talked about taking acid in the 60s.
Wow. That's gay. I mean, that's square.
All right. So moving on with the history.
Moving on. So In 1784, founding father.
But I digress. Okay.
Well, in the late 1700s, there was a founding father. At least that's what this thing calls him. I don't know if they just say that because he was in the Constitution and helped sign it or whatever. His name's Benjamin Rush. He published a study called "Effects of Ardent Spirits on the Human Mind and Body," and then he proposed a sober house to care for alcoholics.
He was a founding father.
Yeah, but he's not like one of the – well, I guess I'm not a humper either way. He signed
his name – well, okay. I mean, stop being such an anarchist for a minute. You know, what fits the name founding father? He's not your founding father, but he is a signatory of the Declaration of Independence, and he attended the Continental Congress. That's a founding father, okay?
Okay. He's founding father. Anyway, still seems at that point like it's mostly stateless, like he's not calling for force to be used or the government to be used. Until 1864.
Well, it says it's his article is generally recognized as the beginning of the American temperance movement. Temperance is not sobriety. AA is about sobriety. Temperance is a bunch of nosy, you know, sexless church ladies saying the government has to ban alcohol. Like I told you, I grew up in Chautauqua, New York, summered there. That was a seat of temperance, of the temperance movement, and it's still a dry town because of it.
Got it. Got it. So temperance was sort of the horizontal enforcement coming before the state enforcement.
No, sobriety is the personal thing. Temperance is the state thing.
That's what I mean. Temperance, because it wasn't illegal yet. There was no prohibition then. But temperance was a bunch of people getting together and saying it should be illegal.
Those people made it illegal.
Right.
Those people lobbied the government.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was the horizontal enforcement before the state enforcement rather than vice versa.
Yep.
Yeah.
So 1810, Benjamin Rush calls for the creation of a sober house to care for alcoholics. Now, I don't know if that was state run or what, but 1830, Dr. Samuel Woodward proposes asylums for the inebriated. Now, that doesn't sound voluntary. That guy's quoted in the AA book as doing some early research that led to AA. Now, 1840, the Washingtonian Society, organized by and for confirmed alcoholics, is formed. Will grow to have 600,000 members. The Washingtonian Society helped spawn AA because the guy who started, one of the co-founders of AA, Bill W., it was Bill W. and Dr. Bob, Bill W. was a member of the Washingtonian Society. And you know, he got kind of drummed out of there for like talking too much and having too many ideas. And he went and formed his own society. And one of the things he learned from the Washingtonian Society was to have AA set up to have a sole purpose, which is to keep alcoholics sober. The Washingtonian Society fell apart because they had too many agendas, and one of them was getting the government involved I don't know if banning alcohol, but getting the government involved with dealing with alcohol and alcoholics.
Okay. So I guess a lot of these early things, even though they didn't have the state involvement at the time, they were pushing for it, is sort of what it seems like now.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, according to this timeline, in 1864, the New York State Inebriate Asylum opened in 1864 and was the first of its kind in the country. And there's a little picture there, too, and it looks like this giant Gotham-type building that's just scary.
Looks like a prison. Looks like a medieval prison.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and 1845, the sale of liquor is proclaimed illegal in New York, only to be repealed 2 years later. So, as usual, you know, New York and California leading the charge of nanny shit.
Of course. Yeah. Although there were some competing threads. I mean, I don't know if you know anything about these Keeley Institutes, but the timeline says in 1879, a person named Leslie Keeley said that drunkenness is a disease and I can cure it, and opened 120 Keeley Institutes across the United States. It was a for-profit addiction treatment center for alcohol and morphine. There's a little inlay of one of their advertisements, and it's just like you would advertise a new oven for women in the 50s.
Yeah,
you know,
in the 1850s. and then if you look, 1891, 1892, the Keeley League, a spinoff of the Keeley Institute, urges lawmakers to sentence medical treatment for alcoholics rather than jail time. That's where it begins. That's where it really begins. The state getting involved, with drug rehab. You know, right. Basically,
and that's also
like,
sort of a form of corporatism because they stood to benefit from that with their treatment centers. If they get the state to actually
right.
force people to go to their treatment centers, and then they have, you know, a customer base that's always going to be there for them.
And we missed one that's kind of funny. 1880s, Sigmund Freud and many other American physicians recommended cocaine as an effective treatment for alcoholism and morphine addiction.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to the 1900s. As alcoholic homes close, poor alcoholics end up in drunk tanks and wards of public hospitals or asylums. The well-to-do continue to seek treatment at discreet private clinics. Mm. Yeah.
You know, I really wonder, is this sort of an American phenomenon? I mean, did you have something like the drunk tank in 15th century England, or was everybody just drunk and didn't care at that
probably
point?
The latter. I mean, you know, when we're talking, I was talking recently about the history of coffee and how once coffee hit England and America, the Industrial Revolution happened. And mm-hmm. that was because before that, water was so tainted, you know, despite public involvement with it, water was so tainted you couldn't drink it. So everybody drank beer because the alcohol in it would kill most germs. So mm-hmm. everybody was going to work hammered. You know, and once they got off that and used coffee, which was also safe because you boil it, you know, productivity went from a beer based economy to a caffeine based economy.
Yes, yes. Huh. And I'm sure you like that because you are a caffeine fiend and you are very productive.
Yeah, I got nothing wrong with alcohol, though. You know, I mean, yeah. if someone's drunk, like, you know, Garrett was the other day with me on the phone, I just get off the phone, man. It's my brain's my private property. I'll invite him, you know, I invite him back anytime that he's yeah. not. I don't mind when people are a little buzzed, but when they get hammered, they get sloppy and get insulting and then want to have sex with me and my wife.
Are you still talking about Garrett?
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm just embarrassing him in the middle of this whole thing, but I love Garrett. Okay. I love him. And too. When he's ready to get sober. No, I'm sorry.
This is an intervention.
1924, cigarettes are illegal in 14 states. This is a podvention. No, it's not. Garrett's wonderful.
Yeah, I didn't know this, that there was cigarettes or tobacco prohibition that early in American society.
Also in 1924, the Senate adopts a resolution forbidding American traders from selling opium and alcohol to aboriginal tribes and uncivilized races.
Yes, that's racist. We
that is
talked
really
a lot about,
racist, man.
We talked a lot about the racism of the drug war in Guns and Weed, but we didn't go back that early. I actually didn't know that they had forbid it specifically to quote-unquote uncivilized races. And who defines that? Like if you take that to court.
If you're not white, man. If you're not white and a member of the Senate, I think.
Right.
It's 1935. Shadell Sanitarium opens, introducing aversion conditioning, which is, you know, a simple form of aversion conditioning is like putting vinegar on your kid's fingernails so he won't bite his nails because it tastes bad. You know, it's associating something bad with it, which is a short step to attack therapy, which we're going to get into a little later. But
right. Which is also very similar to what happens in Clockwork Orange, where they basically brainwash him to where he'll get nauseous whenever he does the things that he likes to do.
You know, one of the things Ron Paul said in his speech this week in Tampa that I loved was he said, you know, there's a book called 1984, and I read it in high school, and it seemed like a cautionary tale, but I think there's a lot of people who've read it and decided it was a business plan and gone into politics. A business plan.
Wow,
I mean,
that's great.
That's better. We've said it's, you know, a how-to book, but I love that. A business plan.
Business plan.
Yeah.
Because it's okay, for their own profit.
So the same year, 1935, the U.S. Public Health Prison Hospital opens in Lexington, Kentucky as the government's first intentional involvement in addiction treatment. Now, that is important. Like Lexington, it used to be like in the 40s and 50s, sometimes you'll read like old hard-boiled fiction or something and they'll say like, yeah, that guy was messed up. He's headed nowhere but the graveyard or Lexington. And like, you know, Lexington was code for that hospital. And that was the only option for addicts before AA and NA and treatment centers. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So
it's amazing to think that in just about 150 years, American society went from private charities who actually had to have advertisements to persuade addicts to get better to a federal prison hospital.
Yeah.
That, I mean, think about that combination of words, prison hospital, to force addicts to get better for their own good.
Not just advertisements saying, but, you know, Sigmund Freud and many doctors recommending cocaine as a cure for alcoholism.
What I mean is you go from that to having in 1935 the U.S. public health prison hospital. I mean, not only are they forcing that, so it's like not
FEMA,
voluntary.
That sounds like a FEMA camp, man. The it public does, health prison hospital,
right? And all at taxpayer expense. So not only are they forcing the addicts, but they're forcing you to pay for the addicts.
Yep. And same year, 1935, Alcoholics Anonymous was formed, which is important because that was a non-governmental, free market, voluntary, non-profit thing that worked for alcoholics. And they actually, early on, when they started to get some press, some industrialist, I think it was Rockefeller or one of those people, you know, one of the people behind the curtain that runs the world, actually had, like, you know, said, oh, well, I could do some charity with this, and had a dinner for them and invited a lot of rich and influential people and had people from AA come up and speak at the dinner. And whoever it was, I think it was one of the Rockefellers, gave them a gift of like $10,000. And before that night, you know, when it was being planned, Bill W., who was the mover and shaker who started AA and was really ego driven. And like, when I read his biography, the Bill W. story, Pass It On, he really reminded me a lot of me, like how I just grab stuff, run with it, don't check my facts. And that's, but I get stuff done and that's my work ethic, you know, but like me, he didn't always check his facts and was like, okay, this is going to work. This is how it's going to be. We're going to do it this way. And when he heard that Rockefeller was going to have this dinner for him, he was planning. Bill W. in his mind was like, yeah, and Rockefeller's going to give me billions and we're going to start AA hospitals all over the country and have ads on radio 24/7. And like, Rockefeller took him aside and said, like, here's 10 grand for your organization. I'm not going to give you any more because it would hurt you. You need to be self-sufficient after this. And like, that was part of the foundation of one of the AA traditions of it being self-sufficient. Nice. And that's what kept it from getting effed up by government involvement.
Right. Right.
Which is weird.
It didn't just become throwing money at the problem, which, you know, brings people who are just seeking money rather than,
you
know, people who actually
want
to get better.
Which was weird because it was initiated by one of the, you know, Illuminati kings. But, you know, they occasionally did some good things.
Yeah.
With their stolen money.
Well, do you want to...
1939, 18th Amendment, prohibition is ratified, causing the proliferation of organized crime. Marijuana becomes a popular replacement for booze. Sigmund Freud dies.
You know, the prohibition thing, I don't think we should just gloss over. I think it's really important, especially for people who may still believe in the Constitution or be Constitution humpers. How can you think the Constitution is set up for personal liberty? They banned the sale of alcohol constitutionally.
With the Constitution, yeah.
With an amendment, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just because there's a piece of paper that exists doesn't mean it's going to keep you free. You can't rely on paper for freedom.
Worms. Unless it's paper made out of hemp. With a free market and no laws.
Well, some people would say, oh, well, the Constitution was written on hemp.
It wasn't.
It was not.
The Declaration of Independence was written on hemp. Ah. The Constitution, drafts of it were written on hemp, but hemp was cheaper than what they used, which was like actually like some kind of animal skin, which is more expensive. So they used the better stuff for the final draft, versions of it. And actually,
the hemp was the scratch paper.
Right. And when you say the Constitution, you know, there's a document in Washington that's encased in helium or nitrogen under glass. That's not the only copy of that. There were actually, they printed up, you know, one for every state that signed it. And, other ones existed, but that's the one that still exists. I mean, you got a piece of paper you think's going to be around in 230 years? Let me know.
Do I?
Yeah.
No, I don't. Okay.
I have a line in a song I wrote. It says, when I'm long gone and spiders crawl where my brain used to be, I'll remember things about this city street. Things I stole and things I did, everything's hid underneath this lid. Open it up and you might have some fun in life.
Are you inviting people to rob your grave?
Rob my brain. That's what we're doing, man. We're letting people steal our brains in this podcast.
Yeah. In the podcast.
You want to make podcast with me, Nima?
Yes, let's make podcast right now.
Okay, so what's next on your list?
So on my list, I have 1945 next, when successful AA members employed at major industrial companies helped start modern voluntary treatment programs and employee assistance programs.
Which is important because actually, like, you know, it used to be, you know, before AA, like, you'd never want to hire an alcoholic, even a,
right.
one that wasn't drinking, because it was bad. But AA had so many success stories that they convinced, you know, the leaders of industry, like, no, it's good to hire a recovering alcoholic. They're going to be better at their job. And
right.
they often were, because they, you know, they had the principles of the program and they, you know, they had a lot on the line. Although that doesn't always work. If you look at Robert Downey Jr., you know, how many times did the judge tell him, you know, if I ever see you in here again, and his career was dead. And then finally, like, you know, somebody took a chance on him and brought him back. I think it was, who was the guy who's yelling about the Jews starting all the wars in the world?
Mel Gibson.
Yep. Let's stop here. There's someone at my door. I got to go get droned. I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends podcast. Freedom Fiends is now available for 24/7 streaming to your iPhone, Android phone, or other chromed robot turd. Click on the streaming audio link on freedomfiends.com. That's FreedomFiends.com. Check out the Anarchy Gumbo podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night. The Anarchy Gumbo podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com. Would you like to advertise your product or service to a large built-in audience of liberty-loving consumers who truly dig the free market? Freedom Fiends is now selling ad space. Slots are reasonably priced, but limited, so contact us today. Write the Fiends at talkback@freedomfiends.com. That's talkback@freedomfiends.com.
This is the Central Scrutinizer. We're working very hard to spend your tax money to keep you from hearing things like freedomfiends.com. That's why we're very upset about freedomfiends.cz. Freedomfiends.cz is a Liberty Media archive of Freedom Fiends material hosted in the Czech Republic. Freedomfiends.cz is outside the jurisdiction of the Watchers, who employ me, the Central Scrutinizer, to keep you from hearing things that might make you think. My fellow scrutinizers and I do not want you to visit freedomfiends.cz. Do not visit freedomfiends.cz.
Go, go, Freedom Fiends!
Freedom Fiends! Helping the helpless!
All right. So I'm going to open my boxes that just came UPS. You can talk.
Did you survive the drone bombing?
No, it was UPS. Well, let's see. Okay. It's in the boxes.
Good. The opposite. Okay. So yeah, I think
it's free market, man.
It was indeed. So when we left you last, we were talking about how in 1945, successful members of Alcoholics Anonymous, employed at major industrial companies, helped to start modern volunteer treatment programs and employee assistant programs. I think one of the real things, or one of the real reasons why this is important, is because they went on to be successful, first of all. So even though they had that stigma of being addicts in the past, they were able to get good jobs and be employed, and then they used that success to help others. Compare this with state methods for addiction. You know, if you get possession that is felony, you always have to check the felony box whenever you fill out a job application. You have a hard time getting a job at Burger King or McDonald's or being a high school janitor. Those are almost closed to you.
You can't be a high school janitor. You can't get a job at a high school. You can't be a high school janitor. Felony.
But even small little jobs that you think are for high school teenagers or people with no experience are almost impossible to get when you have that felony distinction. So I think it's really important to see that in the 40s, before you know, the drug war really started rolling, you had addicts that could still be successful.
Alcoholics. And it was just alcoholics. AA at that point.
There was no.
I mean,
drug
that's
addicts
alcohol addicts. I mean, you know, really, there is no difference in alcohol as a drug and can be abused. It's like alcohol is legal, which is why
this is coming right off the heels of Prohibition too. So just a few years previous to this, it was an illegal drug. Alcohol was.
Yeah. I got new sneakers, man.
Sneakers.
Yeah.
What kind?
I mail ordered them. Sacony, S-A-U-C-O-N-Y. I don't know what that means. Hip.
Are they barefoot sneakers for your new primal lifestyle?
They have two pair of laces in them. I don't know how that works. Oh, it's two different things. Okay, I see. All right, go on, carry on.
Okay.
I'm putting my new shoes on.
Okay, so we'll keep on rolling along the timeline.
Yes.
In 1950, AA adopts its 12 traditions, which I'm guessing became the 12 steps. Is that
no,
right, Michael?
No, 12 no? steps came first.
Oh, well, AA didn't, 12 traditions?
AA didn't have any steps when it first started, but a couple years later, they wrote up the steps. Okay. They were basically doing the 12 steps before they wrote them down. Basically, when AA started, you know, what they did was they enrolled you into the town hospital, which we heard about earlier, the Dr. Towns Hospital. Even if you were from Skid Row, like, you know, the businessmen in AA would pay to get you cleaned up. And then they'd come into your room while you're kicking, you know, alcohol and having DTs and say, you know, get on your knees. Do you accept God to help you? And they're like, yes. And then they'd say, okay, now make a list of people you've harmed. And then be prepared to make restitution to them. And, you know, then we'll get you out. We'll buy you a suit and you'll go help other alcoholics. So, you know, the 12 steps, they kind of took those four steps and expanded them piecemeal into the 12 steps to make them easier to swallow. But the 12 traditions,
cut it up into little pieces.
The 12 traditions came much later. The 12 traditions are kind of the constitution of AA. It's the 12 steps are about how you recover. The 12 traditions are how the groups operate. And how they interact with each other, how they're autonomous, how they're connected. And, you know, I mean, one of them is like, you know, every AA group is autonomous except regarding the fellowship as a whole. So you can't start the AA group where you drink, but you can start the AA group where you're naked, you know, because that wouldn't really affect AA as a whole.
Yeah. Okay.
Like I said, mixtress of democracy and anarchy.
There you go.
Go to school naked. Go to AA naked.
Anarchy burger.
Hold the government!
You like it.
I do. Love that song. So next in the timeline that I thought was relevant, and this kind of makes me think, oh, okay, so whoever wrote this timeline has some good in them, is they quote Ludwig von Mises arguing against government intervention in the drug issue. And this is one of my favorite Mises quotes, and in fact, it's the basis for my sentiment of freedom of ingestion. And this is the quote. Quote, if the government is willing to determine what are, quote, bad drugs, what's next? Banning bad books, bad plays, art, music? The
milk.
Mischief done by bad ideologies surely is much more pernicious than that done by narcotic drugs.
Nice. Really? That's where you got your idea of freedom of ingestion from, was that quote?
I don't know if it's where I got the idea, but it was around the same time. I can't really remember which was first. But if it didn't predate it, then it definitely enforced it. As a as a moral idea in my head.
I love my new sneakers, and I'm going to do a shout out to them. It's Saucony, S-A-U-C-O-N-Y. And now I guess I'll write them and ask for some money to keep saying that. So
is that the one where the logo looks like a little sperm?
It kind of looks like a wave. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. DJ said they're really good. And I never find what I want in stores, man. So I just went on Amazon and got them.
That's the way to do it, man.
You know, because I twisted my ankle the other day because I had these shoes that were so old that the bottom was flapping off them. And I was on my bed opening my window shade. And I went to jump off and I like slipped and I twisted my ankle and it still hurts. And I'm like, I'm retiring these shoes. I've had them since 2005. They were given to me when I went to the Deauville Film Festival in France when they flew me out there to show the Selby movie. It was like, you know, real film festival kind of stuff. Like, I've never been in any film festivals except that, you know, and the only one I was in was like a real one where like you walk in and they hand you like, you know, a bag with sneakers and an iPod and, you know, a bunch of stuff. And the sneakers, you know, they took me in this room and I said, pick out which sneakers you want. What's your size? What is your size, Monsieur Dean?
I don't understand why filmmakers need to be given sneakers by the film festival.
Because Nike was endorsing, you know, was helping pay for the film festival. I see.
Free gifts. Okay. Fair enough.
Because they hope you'll wear them on the red carpet when you have your picture taken. And everybody went the red carpet and got their picture taken. And they treat you like a rock star. And it's not just, oh, we're going to pretend even though we never heard of this guy. It's because next week you could be famous. So they want to, you know, they want you to remember that if they have you back, if they ask you back after you're famous.
Right. They're hedging their bets.
Yeah, I mean, somewhere on the internet, there are pictures of me in Deauville, you know, wearing a collared shirt, smiling, a lot thinner than I am now, like looking into the camera with the, you know, the wall behind me. And it says like Deauville Film Festival over and over, like they always have for that. And there were like 100 people taking my picture at that time, like real photographers with big cameras. And it was kind of an interesting point and moment of my life.
Yeah,
I can. You know, and then 2 weeks later, or like a week later, I was back in LA, going like, "How am I going to pay to wash my clothes? I don't have money for laundry."
Yeah.
But it beats being a drug addict, and I can thank AA for that. So go on.
Sure does. I was going to make one more point about the Mises quote about how, hey, you know, we can't ban bad drugs. What's next? Banning books, plays, music, art. The statists take his argument, I feel, and they take it, yeah, exactly,
as a business
the wrong
plan
way.
They take it as a business plan.
The statists say, yes, we should, that's a good idea, you're right, we ban drugs, so why can't we ban speech, ideologies, gay marriage, Sharia,
I love that Ron Paul called that 1984 a business plan.
Not just
a day planner, but a business plan.
I hope that becomes meme-like and everybody starts saying that about, I guess, more than just the Republicans, but also the Democrats, too. So
let's jump ahead a little bit on this to your points only, and I'll quit diverting because you and I have some personal stories.
We do, but do you want to maybe save our stuff?
Do a two-parter? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's not hurry it. Let's go leisurely through this.
Okay, and then next? And for the next cast, we're going to talk about sort of these things, what did you call them? My personal experiences with something called impact training, which is sort of a form of not attack therapy, but large group awareness training, which we're going to go into in a lot more detail.
How basically in the 60s and 70s, a bunch of organizations kind of took the worst of drug rehab, what works in drug rehab, and combined it with like pop psychology, pop religion, and cult-like behavior, and did some really horrible things with it.
Yes, and used it to prey on the uncertain in society, and, you know, with some very bad results.
Yes.
But we're digressing too far. That'll be next. We were going to do it this podcast, but I think we're running out of time.
Is there really a such thing as digressing on the Freedom Fiends, though? The whole is a digression. Yes,
it is one giant digression. Okay. Well, I'm going to digress from the digression, and we'll get back to the history of drug rehab. And I guess we'll still... So the last thing we talked about was the Mises quote, which is a great quote. We'll just go on to the next item. 1963, drug persecution becomes international with the Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs.
Is that the UN?
It was an international treaty. I'm not sure if it was the UN or not.
What's it called? I'll look it up.
the single convention on narcotic drugs. I think it was just an international treaty. I don't know how or if the UN was involved. But to me, this sort of leads...
Yes, the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, UNODC, was delegated as the board's day-to-day work of monitoring the situation in each country.
Really? And the UN was so young back then, too.
I can tell UN shit by what it's called, man. It just jumps out at me. I can tell.
Yeah. Huh. Well, that's kind of a ballsy thing for them to do in sort of their teenage years.
1961.
1963.
Well, but you know, you have to remember, a lot of people liked the UN because they thought it would prevent World War III. That's what it was invented for, or they said it was invented for.
Right, right.
And it really just means World War III is going to be an ongoing war of UN nations against their citizens.
Yes, exactly. Well put.
We're in World War III.
Also in the early 60s, U.S. involvement in Vietnam and the slavery known as the draft, of course, led to a boom in new drug addicts.
That's not what
it
says. That's you're editorializing. That's okay, but just pointing it out.
I've been editorializing this whole time. I'm picking out my points.
There's no facts in the Freedom Fiends. It's one big editorial, man.
Well, no, I'm taking their years.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
And their facts, and I'm adding... I mean, otherwise, people could just look up this.
Everything that comes out of our mouth is fact, except the things we're wrong on, which people correct us on.
Right, right. Well, what's the point of just reading the whole timeline as written by drugrehab.org?
Yeah,
I mean, our listeners aren't listening to the drugrehab.org podcast.
Is there one?
No, I don't know. I don't know.
God, I love these sneakers, man.
But I think
dancing.
That's fair.
You see me dancing?
I don't. Okay, I see it in my head now.
They say in AA... that to stay sober, there's two things you need. And this is not canonical AA. It's not in the book, but it's kind of implied in the book. But it's something they say in meetings, is that to stay sober, you need something to do and someone to love. My wife is my someone to love, and my something to do is all this media we do yelling about liberty, man.
Your wife can't be both?
She is something to do. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I'm not sure if mine are reversed. No, I'm kidding.
let me think about that. Okay, go on.
Go on. All right. So yeah, I think it's fair.
So
I think
your wife is something to do. Your wife is something to do, and your podcast is something to love.
Yes, that was the joke. That was the joke. It was nothing but that, though. It was a joke.
You love her. You love her. I do. I can tell you love her, man.
I do.
It's sweet.
But yeah. But okay. So according to Drug Rehab's timeline, U.S. involvement or preparation for involvement in war ended up creating a whole new generation of drug addicts. In my editorialized version, though, I call it the slavery known as the draft, because I think that that's...
Keep talking. I'll be right back because someone's at the door again.
Oh, wow. Another package. I think that's sort of the heart of it, right? I mean, you kidnap all these young kids, all these young adults, and you send them off to some hellhole. You know, I'm not saying that Vietnam is a hellhole because it's Vietnam. I'm saying it was a war zone. Ship them off there. They get shot at. You know, it's, of course, they're going to have horrible mental problems, post-traumatic stress disorder. You see it all the time. You go out in any street in any major city, you see a Vietnam vet standing on the corner begging. I did a story back in Wyoming about what we called the Park Rangers, which were sort of the Native American, not all of them were Native American, but predominantly alcoholics that hung around the park in the city center.
Oh, you're talking about Park Rangers?
Cops called them the Park Rangers, yeah. And the guy
that's so insulting, man.
It is. But they own it. They say, yeah, I'm a park ranger. I was tying that back to the Vietnam thing because the guy I profiled in that, he was a Vietnam vet. You know, he got shipped off to the war. And the way he describes it is, you know, I killed people. And he said that's one of the reasons he's an alcoholic and an addict now. It's because he's trying to get that right in his head, because the average person isn't okay with something as traumatic as having to kill somebody else's kid.
Think about being drafted. Think about being drafted in Vietnam. I mean, I've talked to people, and I know we have listeners who are, and they can call in on the Sunday show.
Yeah.
I'd love it if they did. It was different than it is now. I mean, war is horrible now, but it's kind of sanitized now. It's like it's voluntary, sort of. You know, they make you so poor you have to sign up.
There's the poverty draft, you know, but yeah, that's much different than the real draft.
A lot of the killing is more remote. It's a lot more technological. You're not sleeping in mud. You know, you're going back to a barracks generally now in the American Army. in the 60s, it was like, you know, one day you're banging your hippie girlfriend in class, and the next day they are shipping you off to BASIC to teach you how to use a machine gun for like a week. And, you know, BASIC's longer now, too. They kind of acclimate you to it. And then they would just ship you off and dump you into a jungle with, you know, nine other dudes and say, go kill those people who are hiding behind the trees trying to kill you. And you had to, or you die. Yeah. And, you know, people came back from that pretty screwed up. And also, people came back really screwed up. We talked about this before. In previous American wars, like World War II, they came back by ship. And they'd be like, it would take like 2 weeks to get from the battlefield to your hometown, and you could kind of like decompress and talk to other, you know, other guys and like work it out. And now it's like you're in the battlefield and 2 days later you're back home. And that's why there's more, I don't know, post-traumatic stress. I don't know if there's more now than there was in Vietnam. I think there was a lot in Vietnam and it was undiagnosed for decades.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I would probably buy that. I mean, I'm sure there's studies, so we could probably look up the actual fact, but I guess not right now.
And so a lot of them got, I mean, you know, opium was cheap and heroin was cheap in Vietnam. Very, very cheap, like cheaper than beer and easier to get. And so was weed. And a lot of people came back from Vietnam addicted to heroin. And the ones that weren't using heroin there, a lot of them were wounded and came back addicted to morphine from their medical treatment.
Ah, yeah, yeah. I could see that being a reason, too.
Yeah. I got new keyboards too, man.
Ooh. Man.
Ooh, shopping.
You're going on an online shopping spree.
I do. I don't have to leave the house, man. It's great.
Right. So in the midst of all this, to make matters worse, the government enslaves you, throws you into a war zone. You end up an addict. But they're not done with you. This is where the state really sort of ramps up their war on drugs and the horribleness of this whole situation. In 66, LBJ appoints the National Advisory Committee on Alcoholism. The Narcotic Addict Rehabilitation Act also calls for increased federal involvement in addiction treatment. We all know when the feds get involved in something, everything's going to get worse. In the early 70s, the New York Narcotics Addiction Control Program allowed judges to commit addicts for compulsory treatment. So there you have a standard of the state forcing you to get treatment, regardless of your own volition, which, you know, I think that that will probably really reduce the success rates. I would imagine if you're, I feel like it has to come from within you. You have to want it. You don't have to, I feel like you're going to be much more successful if it's something you're dedicated to, versus something a judge tells you to do.
Yeah.
In 1978, the government continues on this tip. Nixon calls drug abuse the nation's public enemy number one. When I read that, I thought
Nixon was the public enemy number one.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Now, isn't that the pot calling the kettle black? Nixon calling something public enemy number one. I think you got that a little backwards, buddy.
Public enemy number one is something that the FBI invented. It was a hit parade
for gangsters. Oh, yeah. Is that like the most wanted list kind of thing?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, you know, around the same time, people were buying it, or a large number of Americans, at least according to Gallup polls, were buying it. 67% of Americans in one Gallup poll in 79 said that drug dealers should receive life sentences with no possibility of parole.
That's so square, man. That's
life
so square.
Sentences.
My dad believes that.
Does he really?
Yeah.
Did he believe it back in 1979?
Well, of course, the government told him. Although now he doesn't love the government much.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now I'm looking at my cop block article. I asked Pete to add my name to it. My name wasn't on it. It was kind of weird. Which, yeah, you know, it's less a thing about like credit and more like it says written by cop block. And I'm like, no, it wasn't.
I am cop block. We should all just say that. No.
Well, I said there were signs that said I am Ron Paul at that Ron Paul thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So of course it doesn't end there. In 81, Nancy Reagan, I guess because she had nothing better to do, started the Just Say No campaign. And
Just Say Yo, wasn't there a rap thing called Just Say Yo?
I don't know, but I want to do a rap that says Just Say No to the State, or Just Say No to Cops.
I think that should have some punk rock in it, man. Just Say No to the State, Just Say No, like five voices chanting it.
Oh, yeah. That's not bad.
On the chorus. We'll do a punk rock chorus to a hip hop song.
Okay. I mean, that's what we do. Do that all the time. That's what we do, yeah, man. That's what we do. Yeah. The same year, though, there was the Fed's zero tolerance campaign, which reduced support for treatment in prisons. As a result, prisons flooded with addicts. And, you know, I wasn't alive then, so I don't know how they really rolled out zero tolerance, but I remember being in high school, and, you know, our high school had this quote-unquote zero tolerance policy about things like drugs and violence, and I just remember thinking, why would you want to name any program zero tolerance, and how do people get on board with something that is anti-tolerance? You know,
the end result of that is this week, I wasn't going to touch on this because everyone's covered it, but it's kind of connected. There's a kid in a deaf school, little preschooler, who his name is Hunter, and they want him to change his name because the sign language symbol for Hunter looks like a gun.
Yes, I saw that. I was thinking, you know, the parents should just change his name to both his middle fingers extended high towards the teacher.
Call him Victor and just say it's a V for victory.
Yes, there Victor. You go.
All right, man. I think we're at a good stopping point here.
Okay.
We'll resume with Nancy Reagan's Just Say No next time. What year is that up to? What are you at? 84?
1981.
All right. That's a good place to stop.
3 years before I was born, they were already just saying no.
I remember that. I was shooting heroin that year.
Were you?
Yeah. No, I didn't start till 87, but I was...
You were just saying no to quitting your drug addiction.
I was drunk off my ass in 84.
Nice.
Yep.
Okay. Yep, we'll pick back up in the next Wednesday cast, as well as information about various cult-like pop psychology groups that will steal your sons and daughters and brainwash them.
Yes, that we've had experience with.
Yes.
All right. Well, it's good chatting, man. Good chatting.
Sure was, man.
They took our what? They took our herbs?
They took our gerbs. Or our herbs.
They took our kids. How horrible. Yeah. All right, man. Worms. Buy Freedom Fiends buttons. Go to the website and look at the link that says buttons. Worms.
That was live. That wasn't an ad. Good job, Michael.
Worms.
On your knees, you dirty hippies! Jesus. On your knees! What? On your knees, you dirty hippies! Jesus. On your knees!
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. We have Freedom Fiends, Anarchy Gumbo, and two designs for Guns and Weed the Road to Freedom. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists. It's only $6 for 4 buttons, including shipping. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
Hello, Freedom Fiends. It's your boy Dean from the U.S. Get the U.S. out my bloodstream. I own me and that includes endorphins. No one won't ask permission and I won't say please. Freedom fans, one fact that I gotta make clear.
The Freedom Fiends podcast is covered by a Creative Commons Attribution Sharealike 3.0 license. Do what you want with it and spread it around. Tell two friends. Make copies. Email it to everyone you know. Go on the site and comment. This is a conversation. Every week, we'll have an exciting new episode where Michael W. Dean and Nima Vadadi weave their own unique take on the way the world works and how to find your place in it. Available from freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfiends.com.
Freedom Fiends is proudly syndicated by Alterati.com and the Liberty Radio Network at LRN.FM.
Subscribe and tell two friends.
And remember, the only power they have is the power you allow them. We're not saying the Freedom Fiends are the one true path to anarchist liberation, but it's a good one. If you want to put your voluntarist money where your mouth is, consider making a donation to the Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post. Then make a one-time gift via PayPal or set up a monthly contribution of as little as $3. Giving to the Freedom Fiends helps advance education of horizontal liberation throughout the world. The Freedom Fiends. We work hard, so send us some money.